Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll first go to London and speak with an expert on British extradition law, David Bentley, an Associate Fellow of International Law at Chatham House. We will discuss extradition as it applies to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who has just been granted political asylum by Ecuador and is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy with the UK police outside waiting to arrest him for extradition to Sweden. Then we'll look into the hysteria over terrorism that was at fever pitch before the London Olympic Games, leading presidential candidate Mitt Romney to criticise alleged deficiencies in security. Dr. John Mueller, who has an article in the latest issue of International Security, The Terrorism Delusion, America's Overwrought Response to September 11, joins us. He is quoted in articles in Foreign Policy and at Salon.com by Glenn Greenwald, debunking sham terrorist experts masquerading as objective scholars, shilling for the terrorism industrial complex. Then finally, we will speak with the inventor of a new light bulb, a revolutionary light bulb that uses minimal energy and will last for generations. Daniel Lang joins us. He just unveiled BrightSol Incorporated's breakthrough technology at Senator Harry Reid's National Clean Energy Summit in Las Vegas with former President Bill Clinton and Interior Secretary Ken Salazar. We'll discuss how his invention, which will be given away for free to developing countries, is expected to save energy and reverse global warming. Let's now go to London. And joining us now is David Bentley, an Associate Fellow of International Law at Chatham House, a London-based independent think tank on international affairs. His expertise includes law relating to terrorism and extradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Bentley.
Thank you.
And obviously there's a standoff developing in London now with the Ecuadorian government having granted asylum to the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, who's been holed up in their embassy in London since June, and the British government's obligations to extradite him to Sweden. Do you see this as being a long impasse, or do you think that something is going to give in the short term?
I find that very difficult to answer, because I have no knowledge whatever of the thinking within the British Foreign Office, or indeed, of course, the Ecuadorian Foreign Ministry. Who knows? But I would obviously like everyone, one would hope, that this will not be a long, drawn-out business, because it's very bad.
Well, already, of course, there's been statements from the Ecuadorians being quite critical of British behaviour and making sort of dark references. Now, on the other hand, there's been also talk on the British side of lifting the embassy's diplomatic status to fulfil what they see as a legal obligation to extradite Julian Assange, using the Diplomatic and Consular Premises Act of 1987. Explain that to us in terms of whether that, how that can be done in terms of revoking the territorial nature of an embassy, and also in the broader context of what we understand as embassies being foreign territory, and an invasion of foreign territory of an embassy is considered an invasion of foreign territory, and under international law, I understand, is causa belli.
I'm afraid that, like so many people, you have misrepresented the law on this situation. An embassy is not, repeat, not foreign territory. An embassy remains the territory of the host country, that is, in this case, the United Kingdom. What it benefits from, as you rightly say, is the immunity granted to it under the Vienna Convention, which means that its premises are, in effect, inviolable. But the corresponding responsibility of the embassy is to behave properly. International law cuts both ways. And an embassy that doesn't behave properly may find itself seriously embarrassed if it then seeks to invoke international law. And this is what is really happening, that the United Kingdom, our foreign secretary, our secretary of state, has the power, as you say, to remove his consent to these premises being used as diplomatic premises. Now, this is obviously not a step to be taken at all lightly. The immunity of diplomats, the inviolability of diplomatic premises, all these things may be highly inconvenient on occasion to the host country when some diplomat runs somebody down in an embassy car, so on, but they're there for a good reason. And if the United Kingdom is threatening or drawing the attention of the Ecuador government to the power that it has to remove this immunity, this inviolability, then it is for very good reason that it can be done.
So did the Diplomatic and Consular Premises Act of 1987, was that in response to the shooting of the British police officer in front of the Libyan embassy?
I think yes. I mean, it came a little while after that, didn't it? But the difficulty with diplomatic law is that while there is the Vienna Convention, which embodies most of the rules, it works to some extent on give and take and common sense and decent behavior. And it can be useful to set things down, if you like, in black and white. And the 1987 Act actually goes well beyond what we are talking about into realms of what you might call good housekeeping. But I agree, this business is not as shocking, obviously, as killing a policewoman in the middle of London, the Libyan embassy business. But the Ecuador authorities are behaving quite wrongly. As you said, there is an obligation on Britain to extradite Assange to Sweden. Both Britain and Sweden are parties to the European Human Rights Convention. Our highest court has held that he should be sent to Sweden. Strasbourg has not granted him any relief, the European Human Rights Court. And so really, Mr. Assange has a very weak case.
Again, I'm speaking with David Bentley, who's an Associate Fellow of International Law at Chatham House, a London-based independent think tank on international affairs. His expertise includes law relating to terrorism and extradition. When you say that the Ecuadorian government has, I'm not quite sure exactly what you said a minute ago, but it's not behaved well, shall we say.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that, and I don't know their motives at all. I can only, go on the outward appearance of what they've done. But they are supposed, as a diplomatic mission, and going back to their own government, to respect the law of the land in which the mission is situated. And this is precisely what has not happened. Assange was out on bail. He'd been granted bail. He was living with friends, supporters. He skipped bail. He went into the embassy. And what the Ecuadorians should have done, because skipping bail is an arrestable offence, is to say, we're very sorry, but, out you go. Instead of which, they swallow, if you like, that's perhaps too strong a word, they accept his story that he's liable to be sent off to the United States if he's extradited to Sweden. They believe that this puts him in peril of his human rights being violated. They appear to ignore the fact that we and Sweden are both bound by the European Human Rights Convention, and they ignore the fact that it is our obligation under our extradition relations with Sweden, where a case is properly made, to extradite the subject. They are not behaving properly at all.
So, David Bentley, surely this opens up a can of worms, though, in terms of perceptions about who is being persecuted and who is not. For example, recently in China, an official tried to defect to the American embassy over the Bo Xilai case that involved the killing of a British businessman. The wife of Bo Xilai, the Politburo member, is on trial and about to be sentenced, I believe, in China. We also have cases of, I believe still to this day, there are people inside the Spanish embassy in Havana who have been living there under the protection of the Spanish embassy from Cuban authorities. So we've had a number of incidents around the world of people escaping from trying to seek refuge in foreign embassies because of the persecution of their governments. And the Ecuadorians are basically saying that Julian Assange is also somebody that's being persecuted. So does this come down to a definition of what persecution is?
We are not China. Sweden is not China. We are not Cuba. Sweden is not Cuba. What we are doing is trying to run a civilized Europe-wide system of law, human rights, and extradition, which Mr. Assange snaps his fingers at.
But surely the consequences of this in terms of reciprocity and in terms of precedent, that's why I brought up the China and the Cuba example, is surely that they can then turn around now next time anybody tries to escape the Cuban or the Chinese authorities and seek haven in a foreign embassy, can't they revoke the embassy's territorial immunity?
I think you'll find that in most of these cases, for example, China, I don't know about Cuba and the Spanish embassy, but in most of these cases, the matter simmers down. Hillary Clinton visits Beijing or whatever, and, the chap ends up in an American university teaching Chinese studies and so on. It doesn't, but the standoff is dealt with. I don't think it is a fair comparison. I think that it is misleading to treat this as in any sense on fours with people who are trying to escape from the grasp of very violent dictatorships. And I agree that there is scope for, if this goes ahead, which who knows, that there's obviously scope for misuse, just as the terrorism laws in this country can be picked up and pointed to by very much, very, very unpleasant regimes and say, well, the British detain people, why shouldn't we? Well, there you are.
Well, we, are, of course, living with the consequences of the George Bush, Dick Cheney use of torture, where every tinpot dictator around the world is able now to say, well, you Americans torture as well. So there are clearly, clearly problems associated with the idea of, holding up a high moral standard.
Well, again, I think, with respect, this is a misleading comparison to the extent that we are not, all we are doing is trying, as I said, to see that the rule of law in Europe, which has its strong human rights protections, is implemented, is respected. And that is a very different matter. What I would say is this, that the South American states do have, and this is perhaps one aspect of it that people haven't raised, they do have a long tradition going back into the 19th century of respecting a notion of political asylum within embassies, diplomatic asylum. And the rest of the world just says, well, that's what the South Americans do. They're a sort of club. But it hasn't really caught on as part of proper international law. The other thing I would say is that granting somebody asylum, and I put that in quotes, outside the country of asylum, in this case Ecuador, is in a way pretty odd. You can, if a fugitive or whatever you call them, applicant, turns up on your doorstep, then you can say, welcome, come in. We won't send you back to your awful country. But I don't see that there is any mileage under international law, certainly not under British law, for countries outside the UK to say, oh, well, this person within your boundaries, your territory, we regard him as having been granted asylum. You can't touch him. That seems a nonsense.
Well, I think what you're saying here, David Bentley, does give rise to question. For example, Julian Assange is an Australian citizen. The Australian government is not going to bat for him, which would be the normal process, one would think, that the country from which the asylum seeker comes from is the one that would be primarily involved. I mean, it's clear, for example, the Australian government weighed in on somebody that was captured in Afghanistan with the Taliban and who was held in Guantanamo by the U.S. authorities, and they weighed in on his behalf and got him out. They're not doing anything similar to Assange. It seems to be that Assange has become a kind of international leper, if you will.
I don't think you've used the term. I don't think you can give yourself leprosy. But I think that Assange has been accused in Sweden of quite serious sexual offences. He chose to come to this country rather than face his accusers, face trial. If we forget about WikiLeaks for a minute, then, you know, here's somebody who is accused of having behaved very badly towards, what is it, one or two women.
Yeah, I think it's called seduction by an Australian.
Well, I wouldn't.
I could say that.
I'm an Australian, so does the other set.
Yeah, well, I'm an Australian, so I feel I can say that, you know. Let's end up, if we can, David Bentley. I'd like to just, in closing, get a sense of what might happen in practical terms here, given this standoff and how it might end. My understanding is that if Julian Assange were to be extradited to or be given asylum in Ecuador, he would be nabbed the minute he left that building. So is that the assumption, that he's going to be holed up in that building until this is resolved?
Well, you tell me what the alternative is. I think that one way or another, he won't get from that building to his seatbelt in whatever the airline is that takes you to Ecuador, without having been arrested on the way. And I think that Ecuador has not behaved well. It has put itself into a position where it is now very difficult, I suppose, to back down. Equally, that there's no good reason, you know, morally or legally, for our foreign secretary to say, all right, dear boy, off you go to Ecuador. I hope you enjoy yourself there.
Well, that's not going to happen, right? That's what you're saying.
I can't believe that it will happen. But I'm not privy to the policy of the Foreign Office and the discussions that are going on. But it seems to me that the sensible thing, really, for Assange to do would to walk out of the embassy with his own solicitor and to make as dignified a way as he can to Heathrow and wait to see whether he can launch any further legal moves. But I honestly don't know.
Well, David Bentley, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Bentley, who's an Associate Fellow of International Law at Chatham House, a London-based independent think tank on international affairs. His expertise includes law relating to terrorism and extradition. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about sham terrorist experts. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. John Mueller, who is a political scientist in the field of international relations, as well as a scholar of the history of dance. He is currently the Woody H. Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor of both political science and dance at Ohio State University. His books include Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda, Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them, and Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mueller.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And you've been mentioned quite a bit just in the current issue of foreign policy, as well as in Salon.com by Glenn Greenwald. In both cases, they're pointing to your article in the latest issue of International Security, The Terrorism Delusion, America's Overwrought Response to September 11th. And people are making the connection there with the hysteria that we recently witnessed over the London Games, leading to presidential candidate Mitt Romney criticizing alleged deficiencies in security. And of course, the Games went off without a hitch and everybody seemed to have a good time. Would you consider that an example of this kind of terrorism industrial complex that Secretary of State Colin Powell described it as, going off, getting unhinged?
Yeah, I think so. There's just been a massive overexpenditure, huge overexpenditure, given the degree to which terrorism presents a threat in the London Games. I think I understand that a lot of the impetus was coming from the United States for, you know, adding yet more security guards and yet more security guards. And that's very typical. Basically, someone imagines something bad could happen, and then without analyzing it very carefully, just tons of money is thrown at it. The same thing happened, you know, in the Athens Games, which is what, in 2004, and the only terrorist who showed up was one, a defrocked priest from Ireland who slowed down somebody in the marathon for 2 seconds. That was the closest thing they had to terrorism. So we've had this kind of alarmism going on repeatedly, and much of it has been based on evidence, and intelligence that simply wasn't there.
In your article in the latest issue of International Security, which you've co-written with Mark Stewart, The Terrorism Delusion, America's Overwrought Response to September 11, you go into, 50 cases of supposed Islamic terrorist plots against the United States, and basically show how virtually all of the perpetrators were In their words, incompetent, ineffective, unintelligent, idiotic, ignorant, unorganized, misguided, muddled, amateurish, dopey, unrealistic, moronic, irrational, and foolish.
Yeah, those are words that came out of the case studies. It came out of an undergraduate seminar, not a seminar. And I asked the students when they were doing the case study, just tell me what these guys were like. You know, use your own words. Be a good journalist, a good historian. Don't inflate. Don't play around. Just say what they're like. And those words came out repeatedly. Now, if you compare that to what the DHS says about the terrorists, it's completely the opposite. They talk only about terrorists being flexible, diabolical, clever, learning from mistakes, anxious to create major havoc. And they never say, however, most of them are morons, but they just leave out that whole aspect.
So what is it then that feeds this sort of cottage industry on television that in Salon that Glenn Greenwald was critical of? He referred to it as the sham terrorism expert industry, a highly ideological, jingoistic clique masquerading as objective scholars, all to justify U.S. militarism.
Yeah, I partly agree with that. I call it overblown, the terrorism industry. And it consists of politicians, bureaucrats, people selling things to the government, terrorism experts, and they all have an incentive to inflate the threat. And to be fair to them, they are also responding to public opinion, that basically they feel if they say that, they'll gain points with the public, and if they say anything else, they'll lose points. And they may well be right. So in some respects, the impetus is bottom-up, not top-down.
So you're saying then, John Mueller, that the public sort of conditioned to expect terrorist attacks, that certainly the coverage before the London Olympics would have led one to believe that it was all but inevitable.
Yes, it's. And I've been looking at public opinion. I've been really quite surprised, actually. But I expected, when I hadn't sort of ignored it because some of the polls were sort of off the wall and I couldn't figure out what was going on, but I really sat down and looked at them systematically just in the last few weeks. And what's impressive is that there's been almost no change since 9/11, or at least since the, December 2001. If you ask people, do you worry that you might personally be killed by a terrorist? It's pretty much the same level now as it was then. If you ask them, do you expect there to be another major attack that kills hundreds of Americans, the percentage of people saying that's likely or somewhat likely stands at about 70%, pretty much the same as it was in at the time of 9/11, in fact, at the time of September 2001. If you ask people, do you feel safer from terrorism? If anything, they feel less safe than they did 8 years ago. So it's really pretty impressive. What happens is it's just become sort of internalized, I guess, and that's just the way people react to it. And, of course, they've not had very many cues coming out of the administration suggesting things might be somewhat not quite that severe, but they still hang on to it. When you get a huge percentage of people saying I'm very worried or somewhat worried about being killed by a terrorist, this is a situation 11 years after 9/11 when there's been virtually nothing in the way of terrorism in the United States, and in which the official rhetoric has declined somewhat, particularly under the Obama administration. It's still too hysterical for my taste, but it's certainly not as bad as it was under the Bush administration. And the press hasn't been covering it very much either. They're not screaming very much. So even though they're not getting those cues either from the government or from the press, nonetheless, the concern levels, judging from these polls, has remained as high as it ever has been.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who is the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State University. And he has an article at International Security, The Terrorism Delusion, America's Overwrought Response to September 11. This has been referenced by an article in Foreign Policy and by Glenn Greenwald at Salon.com. Now, just in terms of the money that we've spent on anti-terrorism since 9/11, and on Homeland Security, my understanding is that it's at least $1 trillion, and the risk of dying at the hands of a domestic terrorist is about 1 in 3.5 million. So that you could almost do the math and figure out how much money we could all have in our pockets if we had a choice between being killed by a terrorist or taking the money that we're spending on this kind of illusory threat.
Yes, the book I did with Mark Stewart, Terror, Security, and Money, we try to apply standard risk analysis to the expenditures, and they generally do not, as you suggest, come out looking very well. And it's also been the case, the question is always, the wrong question is always being asked. The question that's being asked is, are we safer? Well, I suppose we're safer if we hire just one security guard someplace or whatever. However, the question is not, are we safer, but how safe are we? And following from that, do we really want to spend money to become even safer? And it basically, as you suggested, is that your chance of being killed by a terrorist is something like 1 in 3.5 million. And nobody in officialdom ever says that, with one exception. Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, said it in 2007. He said, get a life, your chance of being killed by a terrorist is about the same as being killed by lightning. He was roughly correct on that. But that's the only time any official has basically said, answered the question, how safe are we? That doesn't end the discussion. That's where you begin it. You figure out how safe we are now, and then do we want to make ourselves even safer? And if we are already safe from terrorism, maybe we could spend that money on things that really do kill lots of people, such as automobiles or cancer.
Well, you could add to the list, though, of sensible voices, and that is former Secretary of State Colin Powell, who said that he was concerned that we were creating a kind of terrorism industrial complex.
Yeah, I think that has happened. You have people who are, they'll lose their jobs or they'll lose their contracts if they say other things. And, of course, if you're selling something to the government, the government says, I need a lot of X-ray machines. You're in Washington very quickly explaining how great your X-ray machines are, and you probably will neglect to say that you probably don't really need these things. You're likely to hide the threat like anybody else. The press, I think, the media have been at fault, too. I mean, I haven't found anybody practically in the media, including op-eds, say things like your chance of being killed is 1 in 3.5 million. Occasionally it burbles up here and there, but not very often. And they tend to stress the dramatic part of it, and then they didn't do follow-up. I mean, I'm glad Glenn Greenwald and also Steve Walt, who wrote the thing in foreignpolicy.com, actually went back and said, did you remember a few weeks ago all this hysteria about terrorists at the London Olympics? Whatever happened to them? That question should have been asked frequently during the Bush administration when they said there's a big chance, 90% chance, that there'll be an attack by the next election. And no one ever goes back and says, were you blowing smoke? Did you have some reason to believe that? What was the evidence that caused you to make that preposterous prediction? And it basically doesn't come up.
Well, but I think it's worse than what you stated in terms of vested interests in the terrorism industrial complex and in maintaining this level of paranoia. Former head of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, under the Bush administration, he's gone into business selling X-ray machines, hasn't he?
Yes, he certainly has. I imagine his salary is quite a bit higher than it was in Iran DHS. But it's up to DHS if they're going to buy it. I mean, people are always trying to sell stuff to the government, and they're going to say their products are really great. And the fault really lies more with the buyers than with the sellers. The sellers are going to try to sell, and it's up to whether it's in the military or in healthcare or anything else, and it's up to the buyers to do it in a rational manner and spend the money in a coherent manner that maximizes public safety, which is what DHS and the other agencies are dealing with in this condition. And they've just done a very bad job of it. We tried to, we were supported. Our original idea when we wrote the book, Terror, Security, and Money, was to evaluate the risk analysis that had been done by DHS. And so we started looking through their stuff, and we couldn't find any. We couldn't find any that even, they did stuff that was called risk analysis, but it never considered risk. Otherwise, it was right on the button, I suppose you could say. And then we were helped a lot because what happened was that Congress, in one of its golden moments, decided to hire the National Academy of Sciences to evaluate the risk analysis that was being done by the Department of Homeland Security. So they had this professional committee look into it, and they worked for the better part of 2 years, concluding at the end of this that essentially DHS doesn't know what the hell it's doing. They were not quite that undiplomatic, but close. What they said was pretty close to exactly what they said. We were unable to find any decision made by DHS that was backed up by an analysis that would pass muster. In other words, they're managing by inbox. They're going in saying, well, what problems could possibly evolve? What could possibly happen? Someone would come up with some sort of movie, Hollywood movie land, scenario, and they'd say, well, we got to throw money at that. So they do, without evaluating whether it would really reduce the risk and whether it would to justify its expenditure. In other words, they were not willing to do the most basic, standard, old-fashioned, codified approach that has been reused and has basically been required by many government, for most government agencies. So it's really something of a scandal. And we're also dealing here with public safety. I mean, we're not dealing with bridges to nowhere. We're not dealing with, should we raise or lower price supports for corn. What we're dealing with is the fundamental reasons, the foundational reason for government, public safety, to preserve the domestic tranquility, practically the first words in the Constitution. And so to do that this way is really remarkably irresponsible in dealing with the most important thing that governments are supposed to be doing, public safety.
Well, this has also led to the militarization of our police, because Homeland Security throws this money away and they give them to all these police departments all around the world, around the country, who they sell this threat that you need more high-tech equipment, and you have this absurd thing where you have kind of, military-style tanks and assault vehicles in some small town in the middle of nowhere, as though that would be a target for terrorism.
Yeah, it's without any sort of analysis. There's been a huge tendency to go for technology, when in some cases training would reduce the risk much better at a far far lower rate. There's some things which really do work. Sometimes inexpensive things are worth it. Maybe they do really a terrific job of reducing risk from some hazard, and I'm not opposed to spending a lot of money on some of these issues, but only after that kind of analysis is done. We've gone through, for example, in the book, Terror Security and Money, we've gone through like Homeland Security expenditures for airlines, and some things seem to have been really pretty good idea, like the hardened cockpit doors. On the other hand, spending money on federal air marshals is bizarre because it reduces risk almost not at all, and it costs an incredible amount of money. In fact, it turns out that the federal air marshals, the budget for them, including the costs that have to be paid by the airlines in free seats, first class seats at that, is $1.2 billion a year. That is the budget of the entire Los Angeles police force. Give you some idea of the kind of money is being thrown at the situation. In the case of the federal air marshals, there's a few thousand of them. It's actually kind of baffling to me how they're going to manage to expend that much money on maneuvering a few people in and out of airplanes and having them sit in hotel rooms and taking a plane back and training them, but they somehow managed to do it. But by reducing the federal air marshals and using the saved money on cheaper forms of risk reduction, both the airlines and the taxpayers could. This is a no-brainer in our analysis, that both taxpayers and the airlines could save hundreds of millions of dollars a year with just manipulating things a little bit. And that basically has not been considered, as far as I can see, remotely.
Well, Dr. John Mueller, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Good luck.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's a political scientist in the field of international relations, as well as a scholar of the history of dance. He is currently the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security and a professor of both political science and dance at Ohio State University. His books include Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda, and Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them, and Terror Security and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Daniel Lang, an inventor, philanthropist, and entrepreneur with 26 years' experience in creation, design, planning, and execution. In 1984, he founded and operated Lang Design Group, Inc., an architectural, interior, and land planning design firm. He recently invented the core technology for Bright Sol Incorporated, a groundbreaking lighting company that has patents pending on a light source which uses minimal energy and will last for generations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Lang. And your design was unveiled, I believe, just a few days ago in Las Vegas with President Bill Clinton and the Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, in attendance under the auspices of Harry Reid's National Clean Energy Summit. So tell us about your invention.
Yes, it was actually, it was we've had it under wraps for a couple of years dealing with patents and was our coming out party, I guess, if you'd call it. What we do is we've looked at lighting from a new standpoint. Instead of glomming it onto the old technologies that we've used in the past 100 years, I looked at the task of lighting and basically the science of how an electron moves and releases a photon is energy in the form of a photon, and it seemed to me back in 2004 that LEDs would be the way to go for that simple change to happen. But instead of dealing it with the way that we typically deal with lighting, it needed to be put into a new type of system. And so what I did is I looked at it from a energy standpoint, how to actually get that process to work using the least amount of energy, making sure that it was kept at the correct temperatures. So thermal management was extremely important. And finally, the optics, getting the light to actually go where the light belongs, which is really a huge part. If you can see a street light from an airplane, that photon is never going to hit the street. So using those three disciplines, we were able to dramatically cut the cost of lighting tremendously. And then our focus was then to put it into a package in multiple types of packages. And in my experience as an architect, I dealt with lighting for many, many years. And making sure it was easily retrofitted and affordable was very important to us. And then also, since we don't, my family really have an issue with the disposable aspect of society, so we wanted to make sure that we used recycled materials and also that these technologies would go out in a way that would last for generations.
So my understanding is that this new light is it? Can I describe it as a new light bulb? Is that what you're bringing to the table here?
We actually have about four products that we do have that we're releasing first. Which one's a light bulb, one's a street light, one is a agricultural light, and one is a general purpose for large buildings. To replace a 1,000 watt HID bulbs that are in commercial use.
Okay, but this invention that you have saves over 90% of the electrical energy that is current light bulbs use, and it apparently it's made out of 100% recyclable materials, and it lasts for generations. All three of those are pretty extraordinary on their own, but all together, this is pretty amazing.
Well, the whole idea was to really, I kind of look at it as it wasn't that hard of a task to do because the current technology has just been a incremental change over something that we've been dealing with since we discovered fire. We put fire into we started with fire and then started using burning lamps and then put lamps in a glass ball so it didn't get blown out, and then we discovered electricity and heated up a coil, and that created light. So we put it in a glass ball, and then we and I came up with different things to burn. I took it out of the glass ball, so to speak, and took it away from consuming the object that's creating the heat, that was creating the light. So it is remarkable that it's such a big improvement. But given that we really haven't made a real serious advance in lighting in 100 years, it didn't take that long to actually conquer the current technologies. In some cases, we're only 1% of the energy usage of current technologies. We just did a demonstration on an eight-story building where they had 6 1,000-watt HIDs to light the outside of an eight-story building, and we brought a 60-watt fixture of ours and did the same job.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Daniel Lang. He's an inventor, philanthropist, and entrepreneur with over 26 years' experience in creation, design, planning, and execution. He founded and operated Lang Design Group, an architectural interior and land planning design firm, and recently invented the core technologies for Bright Sol Incorporated, a groundbreaking lighting company that has patents pending on a light source which uses minimal energy and will last for generations. Now, between the time you said you've kept this under wraps because of the patents, at this point, since you're going public and demonstrating this, and as you demonstrated it recently to former President Bill Clinton and Secretary of Interior Ken Salazar at a convention, I guess, in Las Vegas, of Harry Reid's National Clean Energy Summit. Now, my understanding is that there's a long way to go between an invention and market, and I imagine the big boys are circling around like sharks, wouldn't they be? The General Electrics and Westinghouse.
They may be. I do know that since our patent's published back in May, worldwide, I'm sure they've all had a look at it. I did get a call from someone from a small lighting company. If they actually saw it and noticed it and called us, I'm sure the big boys have as well. We're actually about 30 to 60 days to having product start coming off of a manufacturing line, so we can do this. But we are looking at it from a different point. 60% of the world does not have lighting. They're still using kerosene and animal fats. So we want to do this a little bit backwards. We're actually making sure that the cost is extremely low to the commercialized world, but then using the profits to nearly 90-something percent of our profits will go to deliver this lighting to the undeveloped world. It's a foundation that my wife and I started, we feel that this is, society needs help, humanity needs help, and having a bunch of cash in the bank really doesn't help anybody. The commercial model is a bit different, and I don't think the large corporations would want to buy us up, given the requirements of donating most of the profits to the rest of the world.
Now, you spoke with former President Bill Clinton about this, right, in terms of how you do this, because his Clinton Foundation is involved in trying to help the developed world. Is that your plan, to work through Clinton?
Yes, actually through any foundation that actually has access to the people that need these technologies. We had a brief meeting after the summit. We actually have another phone conference with his group regarding the C40. Those are the up to 58 cities, but it's Clinton's C40 program, which is taking large cities and bringing them up with better technologies, making them more efficient. We have a call today, this afternoon, with his folks regarding that. probably to start with, we'll be looking at streetlights, because our streetlight uses 1.5 watts to do the job of a streetlight. Actually has a solar film on it that makes more power than it uses, so it's actually making energy instead of using energy. And
Daniel, what's the comparison between the use of 1.5 watts for your streetlight and the current streetlights? What do they use?
Well, a current streetlight, let's put it this way. Over a whole period of the night, ours uses 13 watts of power. The standard streetlight, warming up, uses more than that. They typically, streetlights from 200 watts to 400 watts. There's no chance that you can actually set it up and do it with solar power. Since we're only using 1.5 to 6 watts, for 6 watts is our most usage on very large thoroughfares, we have the ability now to use that pole to make photovoltaic, using thin film, make electrical energy, not only to power the street light, but also then to use that energy to, say, run the do not walk signs or the traffic signals. So it's a benefit to the city. Say, if the city has 20,000 streetlights, that city will save $10 million a year. And that $10 million can go to schools and our children, teachers, and things from our tax dollars, rather than putting light on the street. That's the big difference.
Daniel Lang, again, inventor, philanthropist, and entrepreneur, who recently invented the core technology for BrightSol, a groundbreaking lighting company that has patents pending on a light source which uses minimal energy and will last for generations. Obviously, the reason I'm talking to you, Daniel, is that this sounds like a revolutionary breakthrough in terms of what can be done to slow down global warming. It's pretty apparent that the political track is not working. There is no agreement, really. The Kyoto protocols are the only the Europeans seem to be agreeing with them. The United States is not. China and India, the two emerging economies, aren't. It's a pretty dismal picture in terms of a political will to deal with what is so apparent. Anybody that watches the Weather Channel or looks outside their door knows that something's happening to our climate in a radical way. My assumption has been that the only thing that's going to save us is some kind of technological breakthrough. And so let's talk in terms of what this invention could do globally, given that you are intent on distributing it through nonprofit foundations to the third world. Have you crunched any numbers on what?
Yes, we actually have. I can make it very simple. Lighting currently uses 22% of our electricity needs in this country, in most developed countries. It also adds another 8% of the electricity used to cool off indoor spaces because of the heat that they provide. So if our technology or lighting was used globally, it would reduce the amount of energy needed by 28 to 30%. That's huge numbers. Now, obviously, it can't happen overnight, but all of the technologies that we're working on, and lighting is just one of them, are designed to be extremely efficient, have extremely long lifetime, so we're not remanufacturing these staples of life, of sustaining life, over and over again. So we actually are focused on getting these lighting products out as quickly as possible and getting them into the hands of not only developed nations, but the reason we're doing really passionate about getting this into the third world is they currently have the opposite problem that we have. You know, we're making a lot of pollution and changing our climate. They don't have electricity. The one third of humanity has no access to electricity. So if they are to go the route we did, as China's trying to do, you know, we took 200 years to get where we are. They're trying to do it over lunch. We're going to have major problems What we're seeing right now in the climate change is just the beginning if we don't start to work this, start pushing it back the other direction.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute here, how have you been funded so far? Obviously, have you had any federal funds? You know, since the Solyndra scandal, a lot of people have seized on the idea that green technology is a boondoggle, and
we are completely bootstrapped. My wife and I, Stacy, and I shut down our businesses to actually put out a number of my inventions, and we're 100% bootstrapped, some friends and family, and just our own savings to do this. And we decided, well, if we're going to jump off the cliff, let's do it and give these things a shot. And I knew I could do the technology, the commercialization, and the time it would take to go from the technology to market. It's been 2.5 years, and we're running on the cusp of manufacturing. We've located the facility that we're going to start. We're also manufacturing local, manufacture local to sell local. So if we're manufacturing in the U.S., we sell to the U.S. If we're manufacturing in China, we sell to China. It creates jobs. It cuts shipping costs. It cuts the oil that's used in shipping. I use cost a lot as far as environmental costs more than monetary costs, because we could actually have them made cheaper in China for the U.S. market. But when you look at the cheaper economically, but not cheaper environmentally, so look at that. We look at the whole picture. So we have not gotten any funding from the government or large VCs, mostly because, to be honest, we don't have the bandwidth to apply for all the different types of fundings, and we neither of us have any background in research and grants. From VCs, venture capitalist firms, our business model of wanting to give away just doesn't fit with their their programs.
They think you're nuts, right?
Yes, they do.
Well, look, Daniel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very, very welcome, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Lang, who's an inventor, philanthropist, and entrepreneur with 26 years' experience in creation, design, planning, and execution. In 1984, he founded and operated Lang Design Group, Inc., an architectural interior and land planning design firm, and he recently invented the core technologies for BrightSol Incorporated, a groundbreaking lighting company that has patents pending on a light source which uses minimal energy and will last for generations. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.